What is in the plant is now reduced to a powder, put into a pill or potion, and sold for $150 billion, give or take. That leads us to ask, is what is in the pill or potion worth all those dollars?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1264th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Lima who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, a few years back, I had the opportunity to visit the Shipibo Indians who live along the banks of the Rio Ucayali, which is the Peruvian headwater of the great Amazon River. I was a guest of the Amazon Herb Company, which contracted with the Shipibo to sustainably harvest medicinal herbs from the rainforest. After they were harvested, the herbs were boated upriver to Pucallpa, where to be concentrated and bundled for shipment to the States, where they were further concentrated and packaged into consumer-ready containers for shipment to people throughout the country. When we finally reached the Shipibo village after one very long boat ride, I was amazed at how tropically beautiful it was. And the Shipibo were every bit as beautiful. We drank, danced, and feasted on food harvested from right there. And that food was delicious, even down to the last roasted piranha. The big treat of the adventure, though, was a long walk through the rainforest with the Shipibo curandero. I took a photograph of him as he offered up a communal glass jar filled with the jungle juice I later learned was called ayahuasca. The photo of the ayahuasca offering was perfectly in focus, but the curandero holding the jar was completely a blur. What made the botanicals from the Amazon so attractive to those doing the business was their potency. The Amazon basin is an extremely competitive environment for all forms of life. When life passes in the basin, death does not linger. The remains of what passed is immediately disassembled and taken back up to the living canopy. You can actually see this happening in real time if you watch a leaf that falls to the ground in front of you. To survive in the Amazon, all forms of life must develop very potent defense mechanisms, and the curandero know how to use those defenses in various plants to help the Shipibo people survive. But here, in what we call civilization, most medicinal herbs are not grown in challenging competitive environments. On the contrary, many, if not most, are grown in large industrial farms by farmers with powerful defense weapons. That leads us to ask, is what is in the pill worth all those dollars? And who better to ask than Anne Armbrecht, who is the author of The Business of Botanicals. Dr. Anne, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, it's nice to be here. Let the folks know that you've been skiing all day and are nice and mellow at this time of day. So
exactly.
Thank you for joining us, and I'm really happy to have you aboard. So you've got quite a resume. You sound like a very, very busy girl. You have a PhD in anthropology from Harvard. You're the author of the Sustainable Herbs Program, which is now operated under the auspices of the American Botanical Council. You're a documentarian. Newman is the name of your documentary. You're the author of The Business of Botanicals that is so hot off the press that it burned my fingers when I picked it up. So, but first, the big question that I really wanted to ask you in considering your resume and all of the anthropologists that I happen to have on the Food Chain Radio program, do all anthropologists like adventuring about in mysterious places and cultures?
Well, it could be a common thread.
A common thread, you say. Well, and you've been doing some wandering around in some very interesting places, like Tibet.
Nepal. I was working with Tibetans in Nepal who had resettled from, who had fled from the...
From the Chinese Communist Party, yep. Right? Yeah.
Yep.
And how...
So I, right after college, I went and was teaching English in Tibetan refugee communities.
Mm-hmm. How did that experience affect you as being right out of college and going into... They have a very, very high air, thin air.
Yeah, I don't know if it was the thin air affected me so much, but the, you know, it was in the mid-1980s, and, you know, it's always kind of annoying when people say the world was a different place then, but it was. And
well, I think everything that happened after COVID is, or everything that happened before COVID is now back in the day.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All new now, but back then, in 1980s, that was a pretty new territory, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, plenty of people had been to the Himalayas. But for me, though, to be, you know, to travel alone halfway around the world, and I was living in a Tibetan refugee community with a family, and working in their school, and it was an amazing adventure to. Everything was new.
Mm-hmm. And now, is that where you got a hankering for becoming an anthropologist?
Right. So I went to Nepal, and I took the job teaching English just because I wanted to get to Nepal. I had actually been assigned to go to the Peace Corps in West Africa and decided for a variety of reasons against that. Someone asked me where I most wanted to go in the world, and I was near a map, and I pointed to the Himalayas. So I got to Nepal and was just teaching, but I was really interested in writing. And the Tibetan man I was working for was interested in someone sort of documenting the history of the Tibetan resettlement in Nepal. And so I was there, and I said, I'll do that. And then he was a very kind man and didn't like to say no, and so he said, okay. And so I did that and interviewed a lot of Tibetans, and as I was doing that, I wondered how I would do it if I knew what I was doing. And so that made me curious about anthropology.
There you go.
And so then when I came home, I studied that more.
And you turned that experience into a PhD thesis, did you not?
Yes.
And a book entitled?
Thin Places.
There you go.
That Pilgrimage Home. Mm-hmm.
All right. And with respect to anthropology... you picked up the business of botanicals, and how did you decide that you wanted to focus on, what was the apple that fell on Dr. Ann's head that she said, well, you know, I'm going to look into this business here?
I know. Well, it's this kind of meandering continuation of that thread. So I went back to, went to grad school, and then I wanted to get back to the Himalayas, and when I was returned for research for my doctorate, I was working in a village in the upper, looking at what villagers thought of this conservation project that was just created. And a lot of my research ended up not being so much about that conservation project because they didn't think much of it, but it was about their relationship to the land and sort of land ownership and the relationship that the priests and shamans had with the land and the plants and all of that. I wasn't studying ethnobotany in any way, but that made me curious just about indigenous, you know, there was a sense that they had a different quality of relationship with the environment where they lived. It wasn't this resource to exploit. They, you know, had to live in give and take. It's giving offerings for rain or so that the rice harvest would come in and things like that. And so that sense of a relationship rather than treating it as an object really intrigued me, as did the spiritual dimension of healing, that it wasn't just a physical, material experience. And well, so those seeds were kind of planted, and then I came home, and I went to an herb conference and discovered Western herbal medicine, which had a lot of those seeds in the herbal medicine that I learned about there, which was through Rosemary Gladstar.
So you made a connection. You know, as a scientist, I wonder, as you looked and lived with those people who probably led a much simpler lifestyle than we lead here in the United States, do you think that they have the opportunity to see their relationship with nature and with the spirit world in an entirely different way?
So I went and I had a lot of romantic ideas about, you know, this rural community having a lot of answers that I thought we have lost in the West. And, you know, I quickly saw that things are always more complicated close up and nothing is as simple and no one has all the answers. So, you know, some of the people, the men and women I became closest to in the village, they couldn't understand why in the world, when I could go anywhere in the world, I had come to live in their village for 2 years. And, you know, and I'm from West Virginia, and when I wanted to go to Nepal, a good friend of my family's, you know, said, you could just stay in West Virginia and find similar things, you know, go out into, and so there's always something around the corner, right, that we all hankering to see and experience. And
well, let's pick up this whole notion of the business of botanicals, as I've been kind of fascinated watching the industry grow hugely in a relatively short period of time. And I suspect studying it in a way that you studied it as an academic pursuit, you probably had the opportunity to actually, you know, measure that growth in a very short period of time. Can you give us a quick thumbnail? We're going to take a quick break here in about a minute, but can you give us a quick thumbnail of that growth over the past few decades?
Oh, I'm not a good one with numbers. I can, you know, I can read from the book, but
well, just a thumbnail.
Big.
Big. Well, essentially, it went from a handcrafting kitchen kind of endeavor to this massive, in your book, you say, somewhere in the neighborhood of $150 billion a year. That's a huge, huge growth in a relatively, maybe a few decades long. And so that raises a huge, you know, number of questions for me, like, why? What is it that we suddenly discovered in herbs that caused us to take out our pocketbook and buy the little bottles on the shelves at the grocery store? What's in those bottles? Is it really worth the money that we're spending on it? So that's the subject of today's discussion on the Food Chain Radio program. We are fortunate enough to have Ann Armbrecht, who is the PhD anthropologist from Harvard and the author of The Business of Botanicals. So we should be able to have some fun digging in to how this incredibly large business formed so quickly and where it's going to take us. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back. Please do stay tuned.
now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And Umbrecht, and you. And we're talking about the business of botanicals, which essentially are plants that have been refined to some extent and stuck in a bottle. And then certain claims are made about those herbs, like it does this and it does that, which is skating on thin ice. But that's what people do. And we have bought into it to the extent that we're now spending $150 billion around the world doing so. And in the book, The Business of Botanicals, Anne Umbrecht makes note of the fact that here in the United States and Asia are the big, huge customers of botanicals. And there is a lot of history in the use of botanicals. Did you dig into that, Anne, as you did your research?
Yeah, and that's what, when you were talking about sort of suddenly coming out of the kitchens and this astronomical growth, and in part it did, but there are different threads that feed into the current botanical industry. And a big one is the eclectics, who were medical practitioners at the end of the 1800s and into the 1920s. And, you know, every local pharmacy would have liquid extracts made by, which were botanical extracts. Park Davis, Lilly, you know, big pharmaceutical companies would carry these. And there was a really, and I talk about this in the book, there was a quite large trade of what were called raw drugs, but were, you know, dried botanicals, and they came from Appalachia, and the Shakers grew a fair number of them. And these would be exported, they would be manufactured in the United States into liquid extracts. They were exported to the European market. And so to stay with that thread. And then in the beginning in the early 1920s, but up to the 1950s, the eclectics died out. And so with the eclectics dying out, the whole manufacturing of botanical extracts died out.
When you call them eclectics, what do you mean by eclectics?
Eclectics. It's the name of the medical tradition.
Okay. Good.
Eclectics. Because they drew from a variety of different medical traditions.
Okay.
But there were the eclectic medical schools, and Cincinnati was a big hub for them. And there's now a museum to commemorate that work that in Cincinnati. But anyway, so though with dying out of the medical schools, the manufacturing, that supply chain died out. And with that, when there was no longer a market for these botanicals, the knowledge about finding quality also became lost. So the whole field of pharmacognosy, which really understands the, you know, chemical constituents and the qualities of botanicals and how they will have an impact on the body, that died out in the United States. This didn't die out in Europe, where that tradition remained quite strong, or in other countries with Ayurveda in India or Tibetan medicine in Tibet. You know, those have had this continuation of the medical knowledge and then the supply chain for that, to support that medical knowledge. But in the U.S., it really died out with the rise of pharmaceuticals and...
Around what year was that? Do you recall?
1930s and 40s.
1930s and 40s.
You know, it was a gradual... There was the Flexner Report, which contributed to the shifting and the rise of biomedicine as the main tradition in that was practiced in the United States. It made it harder for the other schools, different traditions, to maintain students and to get sort of past the...
What is the essential difference between the botanicals and the allopathics medications?
Well, botanicals are, you know, all the natural medicine traditions rise from the idea that in nature is our healing. And so it's really an alignment with that. And then plants can help the body be well. But it's not a single bullet kind of this for that, you know, you attack this cell. with this chemical and have this effect. In the film that we produced, Newman, that's really what the film was celebrating. It was really looking at this rich tradition of tradition that's the roots of traditional Western herbalism, which has become much more disparate, as I was, for those reasons I was saying, compared to, say, Ayurveda or, you know, in Europe, where there's a really strong phytopharmaceutical tradition, which is plant-based. Mm-hmm. And so then here in the U.S. in the 60s and 70s, there was a resurgence of herbal medicine, which came with the back-to-land movement in part. There was also a strong tradition of Mormons who used more powdered extracts, and that was in Utah. And so those traditions came together, you know, coming out of California and grow your own medicine, and then slowly that grew and grew until we have the current industry now.
But. And to what do you attribute the explosive growth? I mean, there must have been something that, you know, led us from the 60s to a bunch of hippies up in Mendocino County, you know, growing pot and herbs, to what the industry has become today. Why did we decide to buy into this as a culture?
I don't know if I would. I wouldn't say it. Why we have bought into it as a culture. I think there are, first, one thing I learned in the process of doing this book is that it doesn't work to talk about it as the industry, because it's much more complex than that, and there are all sorts of kinds of companies within that. There are companies, the ones that I focus on in this book, that have really high quality control, that practices and standards. And so that was like the first bar of what I would focus on, that what is in the bottle or in the, you know, powdered extract or whatever they are producing is what they claim it is. And they have extensive lab research, you know, to document that. So it's not that consumers are being duped.
I didn't suggest that consumers are being duped. I'm suggesting that consumers are looking for hope. And instead of, you know, perhaps running to the doctor, they're running to herbs because they're hope. They have hope in their hearts, and they're looking for something that will bring hope to them.
And the idea and plants that they have fewer side effects.
Yeah.
And I think that the challenge has been, you asked what led to the big rise, and there was the DSHEA, which is the regulation.
There you go. That's what I was looking for.
Right, that allowed botanicals to be sold.
Yeah. Let's dig into the DSHEA laws a little bit, because I think that's really what allowed for the industry, the botanical industry, to step out and say, "Hey, look us over." And would you describe? Go ahead.
Well, before talking about DSHEA, I wanted to say that there are these, what I was saying, the different types of companies, ones with really high quality control standards, ones that pay a lot, invest a lot in sourcing the raw material, and so that they know where the plants are being grown or wild harvested, and they follow that all the way through from source to finished product, so that there's a chain, a transparent,
a documented chain.
Yeah, so they know how it's been handled all along the way. And those are companies that go above and beyond the regulations that are required by under DSHEA and the good manufacturing practices. And then they're the companies that, you know, meet all those regulatory requirements. And then there are those that aren't so great. And anybody in the botanical, anybody I've spoken with, say that there's a number that always are, you know, seeking to cut corners, can't be sure. Mm-hmm. Can't be sure that what is in the bottle is actually what they claim.
Chasing the dollar instead of the customer. Then, well, how does?
But let me say one more thing. And so in writing this book, I had to really decide. So the media likes to cast the industry in quite black and white terms. It's like either all good or all bad. And then they either celebrate it or discredit it. And I had to decide, okay, what am I trying to do here? And how am I going to write about the things that aren't so great about this industry? And so early on, I decided I really wanted to focus on the companies who are trying to do it right and the challenges that they face and what we as a general public can do to really help both them do it more right, help them succeed, and inspire more companies to just do this business right for the people and the plants all along the way.
Well, you could provide the listening audience with a great service by telling us how you found out which companies did it right, so that we could do the same thing. How did you, among all the companies, how did you figure out which ones were doing it right?
And people always ask me, what company do I buy from? Mm-hmm. And early on when I was studying herbal medicine, herbalists will recommend particular companies that they know, and they're, they know, often they're started by herbalists. And so I think that's the first thing to look and make sure. You know, it takes work on the consumer's part. Yeah. It's not just go in and what do I grab from the shelf? It takes digging in a little bit and knowing how to ask, what questions to ask, and how to ask questions. I would talk to CEOs and they would all say, when consumers ask us questions, we listen. You know, so if you want to know something, check a website out, see who's on their staff. Are there herbalists on the staff first? Because a product will be formulated either by an herbalist who is really thinking about traditional systems of using plant medicine, or it's by a formulator who's trying to make something that sounds good from a marketing perspective. Mm-hmm. And so you really want someone who's knowledgeable about what the material they're working with.
So it helps to know somebody to begin with then, right? If you're serious about becoming...
Yeah, you can dig around a little bit. I mean, you know, I think the more people ask, the more companies are going to have to say who's on their staff. But if, you know, I was thinking about black cohosh. I was doing some work on black cohosh, which is wild harvested, 95% is wild harvested from Appalachia. And so I looked on Amazon for, I don't know, I took 15 companies and I emailed them all and I asked where they got their black cohosh. And I don't know, 2/3 said they cultivated it, which I knew was not likely. And when I asked for more, they couldn't really supply me with more information.
Oh.
But I think if everybody were to email a company and say, where did you get your chamomile? And just that's the most important thing, is that companies know where the herbs come from and that they're following that.
Do not most medicinal herbs now come from China?
No, not at all.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah. No, they're, Europe, Eastern Europe is a big source, in fact, and that part of Western Asia, but Romania, Bulgaria, Poland. I visited some facilities in Poland and Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. And then India is a big source, and China as well. And, you know, when I would ask people, you know, because there's a lot of concern about products coming from China, and everyone I talked to said you have to know where it's from. You can find the best quality botanicals from China or the worst quality. And so that's why it's so important to know.
Know some Chinese. Good. Well,
that's what I found in India. We spent about 6 months in India and saw like horrifying ways of storing botanicals, and then top-notch, mm-hmm. better than anything I saw in Eastern Europe. So,
just dig in. You got to find out.
Yeah, there were no generalizations.
You have to become a Harvard-trained anthropologist to figure this one out.
No, almost. You don't. You just have to be curious.
Just curious and ask questions. Like anything else, you know, you just have to ask questions And one of the best questions is always, where did it come from? How did they grow it?
Yeah.
Does anybody supervise production? You know, like with respect to organic farming, they have organic certifiers. Does anybody watch over these sources and certify them or keep track of them?
So there's kind of two big supply threads, I guess. One would be a transparent where there's documentation all the way through, and the other would be that it's sourced on an open market. And the ones where it's transparent, if you're a brand, so a finished product company here, you might not be overseeing the farmer growing it, but you, if you're on top of things, you know the people who are overseeing. Mm-hmm. Like, there are checks and balances all along the way. But similar to organic, I mean, buying certified organic is one of the best ways to ensure that there's that traceable, that people are overseeing mm-hmm. each step. On the open market, you can't be sure. You have no idea, really, to know that someone is paying attention along the way. It depends, again, on how much work
sure.
the company at the end is doing. Yeah.
So if you're buying your herbs to put in your formula from the Wuhan wet market, who knows where it came from? But right. if you know the farmer and you have a connection with that farmer, I always say, you know, food with his farmer's face on it is the closest thing you can get to food security. And the closest you can get to that with respect to the herbs, the better off you're going to be. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, today we're talking about the business of botanicals. And Ambrex says it's a $150 billion a year business. Woo! We will be right back, and we're going to pick up the Deshaies laws and how they changed the business of botanicals. Do stay tuned.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. Metro Farm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Duke the Pug will soon turn 20, which is pretty good for a dog breed that averages 11 years. When Duke was 13, he lost a lot of hair, had a hard time getting up for a walk, and his bowel movements were not very moving. We started making his food instead of buying it. We cook up a big batch of rice, chicken, broccoli, carrots, and turmeric, freeze meal-sized batches, and thaw them at mealtime. We also sprinkle Arthrodex on each meal. Arthrodex is a complete blend of plant-derived minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and enzymes formulated to make old dogs young again. And it does. Duke the Pug does have his problems, but he has all his hair, loves daily walks, and has no problems with his movements. Breakfast is at 7, and if it's not there by 7:01, we all hear about it. Make your old dog young again. Pick up Arthrodex at NutriensToGo.com. And while you're at it, make yourself young again with a Healthy Body Start Pack. NutriensToGo.com. NutriensToGo.com.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place in Bremerton, Washington, August 1944.
Bremerton was the best liberty port of the war, and I had a secret weapon for enjoying every second of it. Roller skates. No kidding. Now, right outside the gates of the base was a sailor bar, and almost every sailor would stop right there, but not me. I kept right on going till I get to the roller rink. Most of the guys thought I was nuts, but I wasn't. You see, there was no better way to meet girls than to skate around in a rink in your dress blues. Back in those days, I was limber enough to do tricks like wrapping one leg around my neck while I was skating on the other. Yeah, most of the guys thought I was crazy. They'd see me leaving the base with my skates and just shake their heads, but heck, I laughed all the way to the bank.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What? Well, I happen to believe that the medicinal herbs taken from plants can make a big difference. I've seen it myself. I can remember once going from Cusco to Machu Picchu, and our party stayed at a little inn along the way, along the Urubamba River Valley there. And next day, we're going to get up and go to Machu Picchu. So everybody was pretty excited about this adventure. But somehow, somewhere along the line, most everybody in the party came down with the turistas. And it was a very, very bad case of it. Fortunately, I didn't get it. But I watched everybody else get it. And it was really sad because next day was going to be our big day. The American curandero who was with us took a little bottle of this potion he called Sangre de Drago, which is blood of the dragon, and put a couple droplets in a glass of water for each one of these people. And the next morning, everybody was completely cured, and we went and away to Machu Picchu. And that stuff, that blood of the dragon, worked miracles in my eyes. Have you ever seen it work miracles, Anne Umbrecht?
I don't know if I've seen it work an immediate miracle or nothing. Mm-hmm. Right away comes to mind.
Okay. Well, maybe I was seeing things, but that could have been the case, easily the case too. But I think when the big change in the size of the botanical market occurred when we instituted the Deshe laws. So would you kind of give us a thumbnail, Anne, of the Deshe laws?
With a preface by saying that trying to understand and write about Deshe was the hardest part of this book. So, with that caveat.
Yeah. Tell us why it was so difficult.
Partly it's me. I find regulatory language and that part of things, just they don't interest me as much. But also because it's complicated and it's hard to understand. I think the key, and so it was hard for me to really tease out, okay, what's the important point here? And also because it's had quite mixed results. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm not really quite sure where I stand on that. And because it's a government regulation, I'm always a bit worried I'll say something inaccurate and get in trouble.
They'll haul you off to jail.
Yeah.
Well, as I understand it, in its most simplest terms, the federal government decided to allow botanical preparations to be classified as food and not as drugs.
Right.
And from that fundamental differentiation, if you are a drug and you say you cure cancer, for example, you have to have massive clinical proof through double-blind studies, extensive double-blind studies, that what you have actually cured cancer. Otherwise, you can't say it. You can't make the claim without the proof. Now, with respect to botanicals, which are essentially plant foods, they're food. And so you can say things about the plant food, but if you say the word cure, that makes you a drug, and you must have the proof that what you say actually happens. And then where I think you might get confused, as most everybody else gets confused, is that those who offer up botanical medications often do make claims and try to get away with it. Like, this herbal preparation will cure diabetes or something like that. And so that's when theoretically the government should step in, but often does not have the manpower to step in, and things get very wishy-washy then. Is that a fair summation in your book?
Yes, I think, yeah. I should have asked you for that clear. I think that to relate that to your question about what allowed the or contributed to the big growth was, before that, companies were afraid of being shut down. There was a lot of being threats from the FDA, and so there wasn't so much an incentive to go into the business, mm-hmm. to the industry. And then once Deshaies passed, it kind of, people would say it opened the floodgates, and so it was a way to come in and make, people came in to make a lot of money, so there was every kind of company. And
some were honest and some were not.
Yes, and the good manufacturing practices were not implemented for, I think it was like 8 or 9 years. And so good manufacturing practices are some of that regulatory oversight you were asking about before. You know, those mm-hmm. require certain,
right.
That certain procedures are followed. And because that took so long to implement, that also allowed for a lot of, say, diversity in times of company, you know, and honesty, you know, of companies coming in.
Now,
it led to a huge...
You made an interesting point. Before Deshaies, going back some time, we have the image of the snake oil salesman who would come into town in his covered wagon and stand up on the back and hawk his wares out. And the wares often tended to be a bottle of morphine mixed with something that would make you feel good for a little while, but didn't cure anything. And perhaps the Food and Drug Administration was really coming down on that whole world before Deshaies, so everybody's afraid to say anything. And also, perhaps, they were protecting the allopathic medication industry, the pharmaceutical business as well. Now, as I understand it, you can't patent plant medications. Is that true?
You can patent the processing.
Ah, okay. So if you have a special steel of some kind, you can patent that process.
I would need to find it. You know, I wasn't looking at that part of it.
Okay.
I was looking really at the sourcing. Yeah.
But as I understand it, you can't really patent a plant. You can't patent an herbal medication. And that is probably very problematic for the pharmaceutical industry. Why sell a willows when you can sell aspirin? And you can patent the aspirin, but you can't patent the willow. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So,
yes.
So then it would behoove the pharmaceutical industry then to have as much strict enforcement of the laws as you can possibly get to keep down the competition. But somehow along the way, people have turned away from that allopathic world of medications, the pharmaceuticals, and are, you know, banking a lot on the potential for botanicals to heal them. So I think, and it must have been a gradual process, but it really didn't take all that long for us to do that. Do you think we're right in pursuing the botanicals?
My view is that it would be a series of concentric circles that we all grow thyme and oregano and lemon balm in our own kitchen gardens, you know, things that we can use to heal simple you know, kitchen medicine kind, what you were talking about at the beginning, and then we all have that knowledge that, and then beyond that, when we have something a little more serious, that there's a community herbalist who we can turn to, who has brings more expertise and uses maybe tinctures and teas, but you know, in my ideal world, they're sourced from that bioregion. You know, some plants perhaps from around the world if they only grow around the world, but and then only that we turn to things like pharmaceuticals when we really need them, you know. Not in the way that they're so overused now. It seems that just as botanicals aren't the answer to everything, pharmaceuticals aren't the answer to everything, each, I think, has its place. And it's so that's one part. And then the other part, in my experience working with herbs and plant medicine and learning how to do, you know, relearning some of that kitchen medicine that I never learned growing up, it's incredibly empowering, you know, to know, oh, I can harvest this thyme and make a steam for my child when she has COVID, which she did. And it doesn't heal it, but it helps support her lungs. Mm-hmm. And having that knowledge is incredibly empowering. And buying a pharmaceutical, you know, being given a prescription from a doctor is not. It might help heal some part of me, but it doesn't allow me to participate in that healing journey, and I believe that's part of what it's all about. And so that's also why what I was looking at in this book is when it becomes the focus so much just on the botanical product, is that healing still in there, or how can we find some of that empowering part of the process that I think plant medicine offers, that it's more than just a product. It's a relationship with the plant. It's a relationship with where the plant has grown. You know, that there's a whole, it brings us into the world in a much deeper way if we open ourselves to that journey.
Mm-hmm. It's the difference between a homegrown tomato and a tomato grown on 10,000 acres.
Exactly.
Now, you brought up a very interesting story that I think we should steal for the audience, and that is how you addressed your daughter's COVID or your child's COVID. Tell us a little bit about how you, as a mother, approached using herbs for your child.
Well, she was in California, so she wasn't close by. So I talked to every herbalist I knew and sent her every herb I could possibly.
So that must have been very interesting. And how old is your child, may I ask?
In her 20s.
Okay. Yeah. So she survived, and that's what. Now,
But I wanted to go, because your example of tomato is a really important one that shows the challenge of, for us as consumers of botanical products or herbal products, because with a homegrown tomato, you can taste it, right? You know that homegrown tomato is not one of those kind of ripened in the truck ones from a big acre, you know, that's shipped across the country. But with herbs, if it's a dried powdered capsule, there is not necessarily a taste, but also we don't really have that knowledge of how to discern the quality ourselves, and so it makes us more reliant on companies and their integrity.
Mm-hmm. Right? And how do we know? You know, unless we, become a PhD researcher as to how good that product is. And I wonder about the industrialization of growing herbs, and whether that does or does not have an impact on the potency of those herbs. Has anybody ever looked at that?
Well, and that's something I was really, so I started this book asking, herbalists talk about the power of intention, and that's different than what you're saying, but I wanted to know, okay, can that intention survive a global supply chain? But as I was, you know, I realized it's much more complicated than just asking that question, but I was also looking at what is the difference between how the plants are grown. You know, is nettles grown in a small farm in Vermont on a constituent level? How is it different from grown in a large field in Eastern Europe or wild harvested, because it would be nettles from, you know, how much does that impact the constituents? And the companies will test that, and they'll notice the different levels of various constituents. But there is a level of, with the rise of regenerative farming and things like that, of how much the health of the soil and the diversity of the plants, that level of knowing how it impacts the constituents, there's not a lot of research on that yet.
Mm-hmm. Probably not with respect to food in general either, when it gets right down to it.
Yeah.
So we tend to think of a tomato as a tomato as a tomato, but that's not necessarily true.
Yeah.
Not even close to be true. Well, let me ask you the big question. Do you think what is in the pill or potion is worth all the dollars we're spending?
So that's also because the products that are going to cost more are more likely to be worth it. I buy botanical products, but I do it from certain companies that I know, mm-hmm. And I wouldn't buy it from other ones. And so that takes some doing some research. You know, it's like
gotta
buying
pay the
things
dues.
From the local.
Gotta
yeah.
pay the dues. Well, Anne, we're running out of time rapidly, but a wonderful piece of work that you put together in The Business of Botanicals. Just off the press, Anne Armbrecht, look it up, The Business of Botanicals. Thank you, Anne, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.